This is
19.
This is January 19th, 2014, and I'll be talking today about the illusion of a separate self. Not a new topic in Sesshin, in Tesho, but it's, I'm going to do it through a couple of articles that I've been saving up about this. One is from the New York Times from almost a little more than 2 years ago, and it's the title is "The Foul Reign of Self-Reliance." Self-reliance is in quotation marks, and here's the subtitle. Ralph Waldo Emerson's famous call to independent thinking gave rise to every faddish movement in America, from birthers to Etsy to Blink. I don't know those second and third ones, what those are, but enough is enough. All right. So this is a Benjamin Anastas who... Let's see if we can identify him. Nope, nothing here. All right. So, there's some, it's an entertaining article, but some of the more entertaining parts I have to skip in the interest of time. He describes my first exposure to the high-flown pap of Ralph Waldo Emerson's Self-Reliance, that's in quotation marks, that was one of his famous essays, came in his, just to paraphrase, in his private school, boys' school, and he describes this instructor quoting from Emerson, "Whoso would be a man," he read aloud to a room full of slouching teenage boys in button-down shirts and ties stained with sloppy joes from the dining hall. "Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist." This is still him quoting Emerson. "He who would gather immortal palms must not be hindered by the name of goodness. Nothing is at last sacred but the integrity of your own mind." And then the author says, and then he let loose the real hokum. "Absolve you to yourself," he read, "and you shall have the suffrage of the world." skipping a couple paragraphs here. "The excessive love of individual liberty that debases our national politics..." You know, this was written during the last presidential campaign. "The excess of individual liberty that debases our national politics, it found its original poet in Ralph Waldo. The plague of devices that keep us staring into the shallow puddle of our dopamine reactions, caressing our touch screens for another fix of our own importance." That's right, it all started with Emerson's Self-Reliance. "Our fetish for the authentically homespun and the American affliction of ignoring volumes of evidence in favor of the flashes that meet the eye, the hunches that seize the gut, it's Emerson again, skulking through Harvard Yard in his cravat and greasy undertaker's waistcoat, while in his mind he's trailing silken robes fit for Zoroaster and levitating on the grass. Before it does another generation's worth of damage to the American psyche, let's put an end to the foul reign of self-reliance and let the scholars pick over the meaning of its carcass. One question first, though. Is there anything worth salvaging among the spiritualist ramblings, obscure metaphysics, and aphorisms so pandering that Joel Osteen might think twice about delivering them? Is there, he's some kind of a preacher, TV preacher. Is there an essential part of Emerson's signature essay that we've somehow lost sight of? he quotes Emerson some more, but I'll skip to this. As the story in our high school anthology went, the citizenry that the Bard of Concord met on his strolls through the town green in the 1830s were still cowed by the sermons of their Puritan forefathers. We had read Jonathan Edwards' Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God to get a taste. Prone to awe when it came to the literature of distant foreign empires, and too complacent on the biggest moral issues of the day, the institution of slavery and the genocide of the Indians. And then he puts in parentheses, at least Emerson saw well enough with his transparent eye to criticize both. The country had every bit of God-given energy and talent and latent conviction that it needed to produce genius, Emerson believed, but too much kowtowing to society and the approval of elders had tamed his fellows of their natural gifts. The aboriginal self, he called it, capital S, self, and sap them of their courage. Again, he quotes Emerson, most men have bound their eyes with one or another handkerchief, a disenchanted Emerson observed, and attached themselves to communities of opinion. This conformity makes them not false in a few particulars, but false in all particulars. And then the author, society operates like a corporation that requires its shareholders to sacrifice their rights for the comfort of all, Emerson believed. Instead of, quote, realities and creators, it gives men names and customs. So what is his cure for the country's ailing soul, his recipe for our deliverance from civilization and its discontents? This is the aim of self-reliance, which Emerson culled from a series of lectures he delivered at the Masonic Temple of Boston. His Divinity School address at Harvard in 1838, denounced by one listener as an incoherent rhapsody, had already caused an outcry, and published in his collection, blah, 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 blah. Cornel West has praised Emerson for his dynamic perspective and for his, quote, prescription for courageous self-reliance by means of nonconformity and inconsistency. Harold Bloom noted in an article for the Times that by self-reliance, Emerson meant the recognition of the God within us, rather than the worship of the Christian Godhead. This is the essay's greatest virtue for its original audience. It ordained them with an authority to speak what had been reserved for only the powerful and bowed to no greater human laws, social customs, or dictates from the pulpit. Trust thyself, every heart vibrates to that iron string. Or, no law can be sacred to me but that of my own nature. Some of the lines are so ingrained in us that we know them by heart. They feel like natural law. I think of the Buddha's famous pronouncement, which I don't have in front of me, where he said, do not believe on the basis of what the priests say. Do not believe on the basis of what I say. This is the Buddha speaking. Trust only that which accords with your own, experience, basically, with what you know through your experience. That's a big difference. What you know through your experience is a big difference from what you think, the opinion that you've come to out of whatever possible prejudices and confused ideology you might have stitched together based on the ranting of talk show hosts or other questionable sources. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Now the author returns. There is a downside to ordaining the self with divine authority, though. We humans are fickle creatures, and natures, however sacred, can mislead us. So this is the very tricky thing about this whole matter, is what the Buddha said, and to some extent what Emerson said, is to trust your own wisdom, basically, but neither was saying trust whatever opinions you happen to have cobbled together at any particular time. There's a big difference, but how do we know the difference? How do we know what of our views are based on what Chinese Buddhism they refer to as subjective emotional consciousness, just our own conditioning based on who knows what kind of painful or other experiences we've had in our lives. This is the fundamental dilemma, is not looking to others for any kind of truth, mining the truth within us, but being wary of what we think is the way things are. There's a healthy skepticism that I think just comes through practice. We come to see how deceptive the mind is, how readily we grasp at one kind of notion or another and let it guide us, and then the longer we practice, the more these things tend to crumble, and we are left with, well, the most famous, arguably the most famous three words in Zen, which is, I don't know. But even within that I don't know, we can find our way. But back to the article. There's a downside to ordaining the self with the divine authority. Okay, that didn't bother Emerson. Speak what you think now in hard words, Emerson exhorted, and tomorrow speak what tomorrow thinks in hard words again, though it contradict everything you said today. And then he has in parentheses, memo to Mitt Romney, no more apologies for being, quote, as consistent as human beings can be. You're Emersonian, exclamation mark. The larger problem with the essay and its more lasting legacy as a cornerstone of the American identity has been Emerson's tacit endorsement of a radically self-centered worldview. It's a lot like the model of the planets that preceded Copernicus. The sun, the moon, and the stars revolve around our portable reclining chairs, and whatever contradicts our right to harbor misconceptions, whether it be birtherism, surely everyone knows what birtherism, it's this bizarre, persistent racist claim that Obama wasn't born in the United States, or isn't American, or whatever they say. Whether it be birtherism, climate science denial, or the conviction that Trader Joe's sells good food. I like Trader Joe's food. Sue me. But let's see, I got to back up because it's all full of dashes. And that whatever contradicts our right to harbor misconceptions is the prattle of the unenlightened majority and can be dismissed out of hand. And then he again goes back to Emerson. A man is to carry himself in the presence of all opposition, Emerson advises, as if everything were titular and ephemeral but he. Well, memo to Emerson, he too is ephemeral, we all are, but that'll come just a bit later. If this isn't the official motto of the 112th Congress of the United States, well, it should be. The gridlock, this is before the government shutdown, mind you. The gridlock, grandstanding, rule manipulating, and ability to compromise aren't symptoms of national decline. We're simply coming into our own as Emerson's Republic. Yeah, we have this concept in Buddhism of the near enemy. So any virtue can have its dark side. It's corruption. So compassion, which is certainly a virtue, the near enemy of compassion is sentimentality or pity, one of those. And there are other things like that. And here we can say that self-reliance with a small s is the near enemy of self-reliance with a capital S, trusting in our true self, this true self that is no self, our own self. And then I'm going to run through this pretty fast. Just recently I was watching the original Think Different spot that reversed Apple Computer's fortunes when it was first shown in 1997 and marked the first real triumph for Steve Jobs after returning from the wilderness to the company he helped to found. The echoes of Emerson in the ad are striking, especially in the famous voiceover narration by Richard Dreyfuss, reading a poem now known by historians and Apple's legion of fans as "Here's to the Crazy Ones." The message was already familiar when it first met our ears. In calling out to all the misfits and the rebels and the troublemakers, you can see how the Tea Party could just batten on this kind of stuff. In calling out to all the misfits and the rebels and the troublemakers, the, quote, round pegs in square holes who see things differently and have trouble with the rules, the ad evokes the ideal first created by Emerson of a rough-hewn outsider who changes the world through a combination of courage, tenacity, resourcefulness, and that God-given wild card, genius. While Dreyfuss narrates, archival footage of the crazy ones flickers on the screen in black and white. Albert Einstein leads the way, followed by Bob Dylan, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., a jubilant Richard Branson shaking a champagne bottle in a flight suit. This is the problem when the self is endowed with divinity, and it's a weakness that Emerson acknowledged. If the only measure of greatness is how big an iconoclast you are, then there really is no difference between coming up with a theory of relativity, plugging in an electric guitar, leading a civil rights movement, or spending great gobs of your own money to fly a balloon across the Atlantic. In Self-Reliance, Emerson addresses this potentially fatal flaw to his thinking with a principle he calls the law of consciousness, and the author puts in parentheses, "It is not convincing." Every one of us has two confessionals, he writes. At the first, we clear our actions in the mirror, a recapitulation of the dictum, trust thyself. At the second, we consider whether we've fulfilled our obligations to our families, neighbors, communities, and, here Emerson can't resist a bit of snark, our cats and dogs. Which confessional is the higher one? To whom do we owe our ultimate allegiance? It's not even a contest. And then he goes back to Emerson. I have my own stern claims and perfect circle, Emerson writes. With this one fell swoop, Emerson tips the scales in favor of his own confessional and any hope he might have raised for creating a balance to the self's divinity is lost. Ever since, we've been misreading him, or at least misapplying him. As a sad result, it has been the swagger of a man's walk that makes his measure, and Americans' right to love ourselves before any other that trumps all. I think of this preposterous claim of exceptionalism. And now a much shorter article. I'll be commenting on more. This is from... I guess also the New York Times. I don't. The title is "Deluded Individualism," and it starts off by talking about one of Sigmund Freud's famous works called Ego and the Id, where he remarks that the id behaves as if it were unconscious. The phrase is puzzling, but the meaning is clear. The id is the secret driver of our desires, which animate our conscious life, but the ego does not recognize it as such. The ego, what we take to be our conscious, autonomous self, is ignorant to the agency of the id and sees itself in the driver's seat instead. Freud offers this metaphor. The ego is like a man on horseback, struggling to contain the powerful beast beneath. To the extent that the ego succeeds in guiding this beast, it's only by, quote, transforming the id's will into action as if it were its own. I think of Taming the Ox. By Freud's account, conscious autonomy is a charade. We are lived, as he puts it, and yet we don't see it as such. Indeed, Freud suggests that to be human is to rebel against that vision, the truth. We tend to see ourselves as self-determining, self-conscious agents in all that we decide and do, and we cling to that image. But why? Why do we resist the truth? Why do we wish, strain, strive against the grain of reality to be autonomous individuals and see ourselves as such? Now I have to say a few things about the Taming of the Ox. Above the main door of the Zen Center in the link are these 10 what we call ox herding pictures, which depict the stages of practice and enlightenment, and they're based on the ox as a simile for the mind. The mind here, we're not distinguishing between our true mind and our discriminating mind, but the mind. And it starts with first just seeing the ox, seeing that there is an ox, getting some awareness of the mind and its potential, and then step by step getting a handle on it, a harness on it, a halter on it, and eventually being able to tame it to the extent that you can ride it, and then as the circles go on, the ox disappears, and one develops into a full-grown person. We are lived, Freud says, and we don't see it as such. I think of the breath. We all are in intimate, more or less intimate terms with the breath from doing Zazen. The marvelous thing about the breath is that it occupies this middle territory between all kinds of dichotomies, things that we see as separate. So the breath is like a swinging door between the voluntary and the involuntary. We know we can hold our breath. We can voluntarily hold our breath. So we have some measure of volition when it comes to the breath. Between the voluntary and the involuntary, between the conscious and the unconscious, between inside and outside, to the degree that we are absorbed in the breath, we will be free of these two opposites, these dualisms, these notions that seem to be opposite. And eventually, in using the breath in our Zazen, we come to see that to say that I am breathing is misleading. because it's incomplete. Anything that isn't the whole truth is false, actually. So we say this in conventional language, I'm breathing, but we come to see that we just as easily could say that we're being breathed. The idea that there is some kind of conscious control of the breath is extremely suspect. It's extremely limited. Just consider that we sleep every night, 6, 8 or more hours a night. We're sound asleep, and the breath is just doing fine on its own, filling the lungs, being expelled from the lungs, filling the lungs, being expelled. This goes on just fine, thank you, without our conscious controlling anything. We come to see then, in using the breath in Zazen, that there is something much bigger than our supposed conscious agency, our control over things. And this is really quite wonderful to discover. He says, he poses the question, why do we resist the truth? Why do we strive against the grain of reality to see ourselves as autonomous? I would propose an answer to that. It's because because without a self, an autonomous, self-standing, independent, controlling agency of self, what is there? How is this all happening? How does this all work? If I'm not in control, if I'm not making this happen and keeping it in control. To most of us, that is a very disquieting fact to face, that there's something bigger. But then we come to make peace with that and see that how wonderful that there is this intelligence. Well, we usually refer to it as our true nature, our original mind, but lately I've loved this word intelligence, as long as you spell it with a capital I. It's not IQ. There is an intelligence behind everything that's happening. My eye fell upon a wonderful statement by a Native American poet, an Ojibwe poet by the name of Michael Robinson. Inside of me flows a river running deep and fast on a journey into the black mystery of night. When I look, I see only movement and shadows. When I sing, I hear only thunder and the beauty of a moth's wings. Seems to be pointing to this unnameable intelligence that animates all of us. Chinese Zen master said, just get rid of this small mind called self, and there's nothing in the world that can hinder you. I've come to the conclusion that the single greatest fear of us human beings is the fear of not being. This is really what the fear of death is. Fear of not existing. Fear of no self. This is the poignant dilemma that we face as practitioners is there is this natural anxiety about not being, disappearing, and we can see this rear its head. We can expose this in deep states of concentration where thoughts are almost disappeared, and with that the self disappears. The self is a cluster of thoughts. The self is just an aggregate of memories, associations, and various other concepts of self-image and all. That's the self. It doesn't exist in any absolute sense. The self is relational. It changes, of course. And when our thoughts settle, when we get above the clouds of thought, we find ourselves in new territory, which is a spaciousness, an emptiness, what in the text is sometimes referred to as the void. And the void for most people is frightening. It's one of the things I loved about the movie Gravity, the recent movie with Sandra Bullock. I used to think, when I read that word void, that the only way I could relate to it was that it was deep space, you know, black, deep space where there's nothing. Well, we know, scientists know that there's you can't really speak of there being nothing in an absolute sense. But that image of drifting, being adrift, your cord cut and you're drifting off into the void. This is where our associations, our memories, our images, really can handicap us. There's no such place. The void is not a place other than here. Emptiness is not out there somewhere, some black, cold, remote place. This is emptiness. This is the void. So, but we fear it. And so much of our thinking is based on avoidance. A void, non-void, escaping the void, keeping our distance from the void. Because without thoughts, what is there? Well, how wonderful to discover for oneself what there is when you're beyond thought. It's nothing the least bit cold. It's, on the contrary, a kind of intimacy that we all truly long for. So why do we wish to be autonomous individuals and see ourselves as such? He goes on, perhaps Freud is... I'm sorry, I didn't read the author. I always want to give credit to the author. This is Firmin de Brabander, an associate professor of philosophy at the Maryland Institute College of Art and the author of Spinoza and the Stoics. Perhaps Freud is too cynical regarding conscious autonomy, but he is right to question our presumption of it. He is right to suggest that we typically ignore the extent to which we are determined by unknown forces and overestimate our self-control. But why do we presume individual agency in the first place? Why do we insist on it stubbornly, irrationally, often recklessly? Next week, I'm going to do a kind of a follow-up Taisho on this very matter of this illusion of self-control and willpower. But to continue, as we are in an election year, the persistence of this delusion has manifested itself politically, particularly as a foundation of the Republican Party ideology, illustrated most recently by Mitt Romney's selection of Paul Ryan as his running mate. Clearly, radical individualism will remain a central selling point of their campaign. One might say there is something profoundly American in this. It's our fierce individualism shining through. But the truth is, we can hardly fathom the depth of our dependence on government and pretend we are bold individualists instead. Thanks to a decades-old safety net, we have forgotten the trials of living without one. Thus, we can entertain nostalgia for a time when everyone pulled his own weight and was the master of his destiny. That time was a myth, and the notion of self-reliance is also a fallacy. Only after choosing this topic and rereading these articles did it occur to me that it is timely in its own way, this topic, in that our estimable Congress just decided not to renew unemployment compensation, at least not to the same degree. It's a frightening, terrible mistake, I believe. And I bet you those many senators and representatives who voted against it, few, if any of them, have experienced the despair that can come from being unemployed for long periods of time, despite one's best efforts to find a job. I'm forever grateful for having had the experience when it still was not much at stake for me, of having been unable to get a job. I was a kid. I just needed a summer job. And I searched desperately for weeks at the time, and it was just a bad jobs market in Michigan. And I remember keeping count. I went to 27 different places in little Rochester, Michigan, and day after day would come back. My mother would say, well, no. Nothing. And one of the mistakes may have been that I wasn't trained for anything. And so I was going around to construction sites trying to pick up a construction job. It wouldn't have helped that I weighed only about 90 pounds at the time. Had never done any such work, at least I'd done manual work, but not like that. But even in my in these completely unimportant life circumstances, where I had no family to support, no children, no fear of financial insecurity, even that just ground me down. Takes such a toll on your sense of self-worth when no one wants to hire you. Now, the claim, it seems, on the part of those who are against this, is that we're just enabling these people to use government help and get dependent on the government. I don't know. I don't have any way of proving otherwise, but I believe that that most people want to work. I think everyone, without exception, has the need, the wish to be active, to contribute, to engage with the wider world in some form, even if you're doing it at home, but to be plugged into the world of labor and activity. And that, sure, I'm sure there are people who have suppressed that deep need and have convinced themselves that they're really getting something over on the government if they can just lie back in their hammocks and draw unemployment checks without having to work. But I can't believe that there are that many of those people. And I think in that claim that it's just a way of keeping people dependent on government, people who don't deserve it, I think there's racism behind that, and there are other blind prejudices as well, ethnic prejudices. But that's just my own gut sense, and we know from the last article that can't be trusted entirely, but I'm just saying it anyway. Thanks to a decades-old safety net, we have forgotten the trials of living without one. And the notion of self-reliance is also a fallacy. This is pure Buddhist teaching, that no one of us can possibly be truly, absolutely independent of others. We are all embedded in a web of interdependence. And there's a simple exercise to bring this home, and there's many thousands of ways of working it out. Let's just jump in. Okay, we're all here. What's keeping us warm in this room? Well, it's the heating system. Where does the heat come from? Where does the natural gas come from? Where does the money come from for us to pay for the heat in this room? Or even if there were no heating system, we got all these bodies that generate heat. The platforms we're sitting on, the robes we're wearing were made by someone else in most cases. The breakfast we had this morning was provided by, you know, you can do this in every kind of way. Just backtrack and see the layers and layers and infinite layers of support and interdependence. And yet there's this stubborn myth of radical individualism. The 17th century philosopher, I'm back to the article, Spinoza greatly influenced Freud, and he adds a compelling insight that we would do well to reckon with. Spinoza also questioned the human pretense to autonomy. Men believe themselves free, he said, merely because they are conscious of their volitions and appetites, but they are wholly determined. In fact, Spinoza claimed, to the horror of his contemporaries, that we are all just modes of one substance, God or nature, he called it, which is really the same thing. To be human, he argued, is to be party to a confounding existential illusion that human individuals are independent agents, which exacts a heavy emotional and political toll on us. It is the source of anxiety, envy, anger, all the passions that torment our psyches, and the violence that ensues. If we should come to see our nature as it truly is, if we should see that no individuals, properly speaking, exist at all, Spinoza maintained, it would greatly benefit humankind. We are all profoundly linked in countless ways we can hardly perceive. My decisions, choices, actions are inspired and motivated by others to no small extent. The passions, Spinoza argued, derive from seeing people as autonomous individuals responsible for all the objectionable actions that issue from them. Understanding the interrelated nature of everyone and everything is the key to diminishing the passions and the havoc they wreak. Zen Master Dogen, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, put it this way: gourd with its tendrils is entwined with gourd. And before him, and that Chinese master, why are people so unhappy? Because 99% of what they think about is themselves, and there is none. And yet, there is something we can rightfully refer to as the self. And this is what is so confounding, is that we do have some measure of choice. We know that every time when we're sitting and we notice that our mind has wandered, okay, we go back to the practice. There's something, if not choice, it's something very similar to choice. And that's what I'm going to get into next week more in terms of science. So there, the Buddha never said, according, I haven't read everything the Buddha said, but other authors have said that the Buddha never said simply, there is no self. But that what we call the self, this body-mind complex that is relatively enduring in its certain form, but not absolutely, that is not absolutely immutable. There is some mutability, some change that's happening, even though we don't perceive it. So we occupy, just like the breath, we occupy this balance between being individuals, in a sense, yes, individuals we are. Each one of us is unique, endowed with our strengths and crippled by our weaknesses and with our own temperament and personality. So we can speak of each of us having some individuality, but at the same time there is something far more vast and profound of which we are a part. These are the two sides of reality, the side of oneness and the side of differentiation. And they're not two, ultimately. There's a very short, simple koan in the Blue Cliff Record, number 68, called Ejaku's What Is Your Name? Ejaku asked Enen, what is your name? Enen said, Ejaku. Ejaku said, Ejaku is my name. Enen said, my name is Enen. Ejaku roared with laughter. And then the final paragraph here in this article called Deluded Individualism. The last sentence was, understanding the interrelated nature of everyone and everything is the key to diminishing the passions and the havoc they wreak. In this, Spinoza and President Obama seem to concur. We're all in this together. We are not each the sole author of our destiny. Our destinies are entangled, messily, unpredictably. Our cultural demands of individualism are too extreme. They are constitutionally irrational, Spinoza and Freud tell us, and as does the Buddha, and their potential consequences are disastrous. Thanks to our safety net, we live in a society that affirms the dependence and interdependence of all. To that extent, it affirms a basic truth of our nature. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.